as the he's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. four-star general is warning of a U.S. war with China by the year 2025. He said the odds of this conflict with China, which would be over by over Taiwan, are very high. Why is the U.S. so hungry for war that it is even predicting wars before they happen instead of using diplomacy as one of its options? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the coming U.S. war with China, which, if it does happen, may spell one of the biggest catastrophes that mankind has seen. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Don DeBar, activist and commentator, who joins us from Austin, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'd like to start out with you, Jim Kavanaugh, if I may, ask you about this top Republican in the U.S., Congress. He has said that the odds of a conflict with China are very high over Taiwan to happen in 2 years' time. So my first question is, why is he, on behalf of the U.S., if I can say on behalf of the U.S., making predictions of a war instead of thinking, maybe we should try out diplomacy first before we predict of wars that we're going to get into?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Secondly, please notice, everyone, that this is a Republican congressman who made this statement, and, of course, the general, Minahan, who made the statement that we'd probably be at war with China by 2025. So please notice that, you know, there's no political force in the American American political party. There's no anti-war political force. The Democrats want to blame Russia for all of their political failings, and the Republicans want to blame China for the fact that American capital was invested in China. So why is there no diplomacy? Because the United States is afraid of the rise of China as a strong economic and political power and military power. And the United States really can't abide by the fact that there was going to be probably the Chinese are going to be the superior power in that part of the world, at least. And the United States just can't have that. And there's no negotiating it away, really. Now, you could have negotiations where you create a situation where everybody can live with the power of China and everybody can get along well and there's no wars that are necessary. But in fact, that's not what the United States wants. And what they're doing here is, I mean, what is the excuse for this? Taiwan is a part of China. That's American policy. There's one China. That was Taiwanese government policy. There's one China. So why does America have anything to do with trying to go to war over Taiwan? That's Chinese territory. This is really just a little crazy. They're going to Japan. They said they're going to help Japan become a more potent military power in the region. We've heard this before with German tanks in Ukraine and Japanese attacking China. It's not a good song. We've heard it before, and I don't want to hear it again.
Okay. Don DeBar, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. Because your picture was frozen there. Don DeBar, so let's get to the bigger question first, which I wanted to get to later But since a guest there touched on it, Jim Kavanaugh, he has said, why, what place does the U.S. have to even be in that part of the world in terms of viewing itself and projecting its power, in this case in point, using Taiwan, saying that it might go to war with China over it. I mean, basically, to put it in a simpler terms, what right does the U.S. have to even project itself that way?
Well, it occupies Japan as 1945. It occupies much of the Japanese occupation in Korea. It occupies the Philippines, which was the Spanish occupation since 1898. It has taken over the title to the right of occupation of parts of China, Vietnam, and others from France and whomever else. The U.S. is the global, imperial power, global colonial power, the successor to half a millennium of European colonialism, and it would be and almost was hegemon. The countervailing power in the world economically is China. India is also joining that, and basically an aggregation of the segments of Asian and Eurasian economy being assembled, for example, in the STO and other organizations, the military and other strategic partnership with Russia. These are all not just territories that the U.S. are not going to be able to incorporate any further into their global hegemon. And I'm saying U.S., we're really talking about the elite that has control of the U.S. government and the European governments, et cetera. I'm in the U.S. This has nothing to do with me. I make no policy. The large bulk of the 330 million people that live here have zero input into policy. This is a small group of people that own most of what's here and a good part of what is around the world, and they intend to own the rest of it. They have control of the levers of government here, which means the U.S. military has had somewhere between half to $1 trillion a year that they've assembled the force every year for decades. And that's what's been pointed at China.
I'm sorry to jump in, Don DeBar. Your picture is frozen, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to move on, even though we did have your audio, but we got a bulk of what you said there. If you don't mind, let me move on to Jim Kavanaugh and go for the next question here. Even though Jim Kavanaugh, this general, has said what he has said does not represent the Pentagon, but it says that Michael McConnell, the new chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, I mean, these are really, I don't know what type of adjective to use. Interesting statements is what I can come up with. He says, I hope he's wrong, but I think he's right, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, if this is the type of mentality we're looking at when it comes to a war, gosh, I think we're in trouble. Now, let me move on to the whole issue of Taiwan. When we're looking at what the U.S. says, a possible attempt by China to exert control over Taiwan, okay, what are the chances of, first of all, or the odds of China making a move on Taiwan? And why do you think it hasn't made one already, if you think that it may?
Well, the chances get more likely every day that the United States makes these threats. The more the United States rhetorically and its political positioning makes threats which not only imply but kind of directly state that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country, that they're treating China as having no rights over Taiwan, and that they're going to build up Taiwan, and not only Taiwan, but other countries in the region like Japan, there's a history there again, into potent military powers against China, the more likely it is that China is going to say, we're not going to wait for them to build up Taiwan. China is not going to wait like Russia waited 8 years for the NATO to build up their forces in Ukraine. If China sees that happening, they're much more likely to say, we're going to take control of Taiwan by force. So, you know, again, as you've implied, if there were a real effort at diplomacy, which was based on shared reasonable conditions, namely that the United States does not have the right to control the world, including the Pacific region, that China is a major power that deserves respect, and that Taiwan is a part of China, a lot of things that you could have a deal about that. We've had a deal for 50 years since Nixon. So why all of a sudden, because the United States feels it's under threat, it's declining in power, and it's going to try and stop it in some way. And that's why it doesn't want, it's making really threats against China, which it sees as a rising power. And it doesn't want to have a rising power that's going to displace it from ruling the world, including the Pacific region.
Don DeBar, the reason given over here by the general, he has said that both the U.S. and Taiwan are going to be holding presidential elections in the year 2024. And the way that it was reported, it says potentially creating an opportunity for China to take military action. Can you tell us how that creates an opportunity for China?
The United States wants to acquire Taiwan, in essence, as space outside of China, which would be a change in the status quo. The purpose of that is to, counter the quote-unquote threat from China, which means, in essence, to try to stifle China as a potential rival around the world. Now, what we're seeing, the role that a rival to the United States plays, or to the European imperial construct plays around the world, is that you can see in Africa, for example, where countries before had the opportunity to either be starved out of the global economy, sanctioned like Zimbabwe, et cetera, or to be exploited, where in essence people come in, take their stuff and bring it back to the U.S. or Britain or wherever. And China comes in and offers another model. We'll help you develop your materials. We'll take some of what we need from you. We'll build roads, infrastructure. We'll partner. We want to help you make money so you can buy stuff from us, et cetera, et cetera. Alternative model. That is a threat to the foundation of the exploitative model that the U.S. has been following since it inherited from Britain and France and Spain, et cetera. There's, however, an opportunity here, because as the U.S. has been starving its own people now for a generation or two, and China's been accumulating a pile of cash, I see a possibility somewhere down the road where China not only goes, say, to Nicaragua or, Venezuela and says, let's do business and bail you out of the problem with the U.S., but comes to some of the states like Texas and others and says, you know what, Washington's not giving you any money for development, for roads or whatever. We have some. Why don't you look at those rights that the U.S. preaches everywhere else to secede? Consider seceding from the United States and we'll write you a big check. There's a lot of possibilities for playing this game two ways as the United States decides not to pay attention to the international legal system and global order. And China is moving into a position where they can actually work some of that against the U.S. And that's going to be interesting if it doesn't result in the world getting blown up.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'm really going to ask you to forgive me, but were you talking serious about the fact that China might come to the aid of one of the states, or are you just trying to drive
well,
a point there?
The Justice Department actually indicted some people over allegations that Russian agents were trying to encourage separatism in California, Texas, and elsewhere.
Sure, okay.
This was only in the past year, so there's no $500 changed hands there. Suppose China wrote a check for $5 billion to the Texas state government.
Sure. I got you. Okay. So let's see here. We're taking a look at this general and its warning, whether it's from his boss who has a gut feeling it's going to happen or from him saying this off the whim, we don't know, but he has said it. Jim Kavanaugh, I'm curious as to whether this has anything to do with the most recent warning that the U.S. has leveled against China when it comes to crossing U.S.'s red line in terms of material and security assistance to Russia in the special military operation in Ukraine. This comes ahead of the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's visit to Beijing. Do you think this has anything to do with it when you have a general come out and make a statement like that? Are they connected?
Well, it may not be directly connected, but yes, they're connected. The United States does not want to see anybody supporting Russia in its actions in Ukraine. They want to drive a wedge between Russia and China. They're not doing it. They've driven them together. So they're making threats. I mean, it's a bluff. There's nothing they can do about it. The United States has no right to say we can pour advanced weapons into our side in Ukraine, but you can't give any help to the side that you favor in Ukraine. And I'll point out that the United States is doing and Israel are doing the same thing with Iran, and they're going to try and punish and destroy and attack military and military production facilities in Iran because they're helping, they're supplying material to the Russians in Ukraine.
Sure we're clear on that. Sorry, I had to say it. Right. It's not Iran's official stance that it's assisting Russia in a special military operation.
Right, right. Well, the United States believes it is. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Is there any doubt that Russia has bought some equipment from Iran? I don't know. I mean,
before the special military operation. All right. So let me ask you this, Don DeBar. Ned Price says there's got to be a cost. The State Department spokesperson, because the U.S. thinks that there are companies that are providing assistance to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. What kind of cost do you think that Price is talking about, aside from sanctions, I'm guessing? Any idea?
Well, it's impossible to imagine more sanctions since they've been piling them on since 1979, 1980. Well, we got a hint over the past couple of days with the attack on Iran, a military facility. No one, at least as of the time that I last looked, has claimed responsibility for it, but there were certainly some strong suggestions from Ukraine and from Israel that they had a hand in this. And, of course, neither of those act without the United States' approval. And so the situation in general, I reported on Friday in my newscast, starting with the 1997 speech that Biden gave when he was in the U.S. Senate, saying that Russia was going to have to do whatever the U.S. told it because what was it going to do otherwise? Go to China, and he laughed, and he said, and when he finds out that doesn't work, what's he going to do? Go to Iran. Well, we're now seeing those three cooperating in ways that are broader and deeper than anyone would have imagined, and it's during Biden's time in office as president. Mm-hmm. And so the U.S., of course, is not pleased with that. Each of these are the products of attempts by the U.S. to isolate them. They've tried to isolate so many countries in the world that it's now the U.S. that's being isolated, and everyone else is in the cool kids club that was kicked out of the global economy by the U.S. The balance of power is changing in favor of that configuration, and it's causing all kinds of, upheaval in Washington. It's a dangerous time, and when they say that there's going to be a war in a year or two, people have to take that very seriously, and I'm certain that China does, and Russia, too.
Well, let's take a look at a notable event that took place, and I'd like to find out your reading into it, Jim Kavanaugh, where China turned down a U.S. offer for military deconfliction talks. Maybe you can tell us what that means, between U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Chinese Defense Minister earlier this month. Why is that even important? And that's how it was reported, but why is that important?
Well, sure. I don't know what the devil's in the details with those things. At the same time that Lloyd Austin might be saying that to China, Joe Biden is going to Japan and saying, quote from the New York Times, we're going to build you into a potent military power again, and there's a history to that China knows very well. So, and it's very clear from all of the political statements coming out of the Congress and coming out of the Pentagon and coming out of the mouth of the President of the United States and the visits that, high-ranking Congress people have paid to Taiwan, that, the United States, I don't know what the details of this deconfliction arrangement were, and that would be a nice thing to know, and that would be a nice thing to do. But you can't talk deconfliction while you're arming Japan to go to war with China, and while you're arming Taiwan to be an American cat's paw in, as Don said, to be essentially acquired by the United States as Ukraine was, as a cat's paw against China. So I'd have to look. I don't know what the details of what Austin was offering, what China was objecting to, and what the conditions of it are. But I think clearly we're seeing the United States really isn't accepting that Taiwan is part of China, that it's a one China, and the United States really isn't accepting the rise of China as a peer power that it has to deal with respect, and not just preaching and sanctions and building up military alliances to attack.
Well, the countries in that part of the world, Don DeBar, based on one of the polls that were taken, 7 out of 10 ASEAN members favor China over U.S. This was actually a survey. And also they feel these countries, the 73% of them, that it's becoming a staging ground between the U.S. and China. And they're not really into that, obviously. And they are worried as to where this is going to go. When we're looking at that type of favorability leaning towards China, what can the U.S. or what kind of reactions will the U.S. have? We know, obviously, the sale of arms would be one way to entice these countries, I guess, because if it comes down to trade, I think China's got the U.S. beat on that issue.
Well, when you speak about countries and polling data, you're talking about the people in the countries, and then the policy of the countries is what's determined by whatever the total output of the society is, generally in the hands of the government officials. It's interesting to look at the situation in Asia, where the policy is somewhat in alignment with the polling data, as opposed to the situation in Europe, where the polling data indicates one thing, that the people do not want to have World War III fought on their battleground, and the governments are moving forward full steam ahead with it. There's a huge vector there. Remember, these are the countries that have been lecturing the world, including Asia, for generations about democracy. You know, the United States, whoever's doing the planning here, and it's kind of frightening to imagine that this is actually what's being planned, but it is. When you have $1 trillion a year going into a structure, and it's behaving, it's swinging around the world the way it is, it's clear that there is actually a brain somewhere that's formulating the actions, and that this is according to somebody's plan. The plan here seems to be to have a war simultaneously with Russia and China, using Europe on the one hand and Japan and I assume Korea, if they'll play along, and they may not, and Australia and others in Asia to send them against Russia and China. And the assumption, I guess, at least in Langley, or at least a PR assumption in these countries, is that the war is going to be fought there and not here. Russia sending that boat over this way with those hypersonic missiles tells me that some of that war is going to take place in North America, and particularly around the areas like Washington and New York, where we are. And that makes me want to put some restraint. But, you know, our governments have nothing. They don't do anything that we tell them. And in Asia, apparently, the governments are at least listening to their people, or they agree with them.
Okay. Interesting that you talked about, I think it was you, Jim Kavanaugh, that you talked about how, or it was Don DeBar, I forget, how Ukraine, and it was Don, I think, you talked about Ukraine and then the U.S. and who else that was involved perhaps in this mini quadcopter game-like attack that took place, which we've shown videos of, which a couple of them were just blown up based on the defense system that there is there. And I'd like to throw at you, Jim Kavanaugh, if you're seeing that type of cooperation, what are the chances, if there is to be a military confrontation, for Russia to come into the picture to aid China and at the same time other countries like Iran? We know that a little over a year ago, China, Russia, and Iran held military exercises, naval exercises, I must say, in the Indian Ocean. Even though the sounds of all this is just so horrible, because we're just looking at war after war based on the scenarios that are being presented. But what do you think of that in terms of the cooperation of those countries with China against the U.S. and whoever else U.S. wants to bring in, like perhaps Japan, perhaps Korea? And let's not forget, North Korea is there also with their bombs.
Yeah, you know, that would be a very an important turn. I've always said, you know, in terms of the United States, driven by Israel's desire to attack Iran, you know, if Russia wants to be serious about that, they should have a defensive a treaty with Iran, which is a mutual defense treaty. We will come to each other's defense. China and Russia could be the same thing. We will come to each other's defense. I think these countries are, however, reluctant to do that. China and Russia are not at the point, or Iran are not at the point where they're going to commit themselves in advance to fighting for each other. They're going to support each other in various ways, in material ways. I think in this conflict with the missionary imperialism of the West and the military imperialism of the West when it comes to it. But that's, of course, the development of a real explicit alliance between these three countries would be something that the United States would find very dangerous. And, you know, again, we're in a situation where it's the logic of what we're seeing, but it's a dangerous logic.
Thank you for that, Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Don DeBar, activist and commentator from Austin, New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Batapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, pondering. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of pondering in the Islamic lifestyle. It is necessary that when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, we must target the self-building in our life. We must go towards the self-building and the purification in the Islamic lifestyle in order to get the perfection. For that, the very first thing that we need is to ponder in our life. Pondering is the most important part in our life. In the Quran, Allah has said many times, أَفَلَا تَتَفَكَّرُونَ, don't you ponder. There are many verses where he describes about this world, this universe, the creation of the world and the heavens, and after that, the earth and the heavens, and then he says, don't you ponder. This pondering is taking us, it teaches us how to analyze ourselves. It tells us how to reach to ourselves, how to get the knowledge of myself. And therefore, pondering is very important. And the first condition for pondering is that we must struggle with ourselves, and we must think and ponder about ourselves, that the place that I am, why am I at this place? Minimum thing that we can do is, for some time during the day or night, every single day, maybe at the day or night time, I should spare some time, and then I must think that the Mawla or Allah or my Lord who has created me, who has sent me in this world, he has provided all these things for me, he has provided the day and night for me for resting. He has provided the day for work. He has provided me with all this sustenance. What is this all for? And if I can think and ponder about it, about my body, which is healthy, which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then I can achieve the perfection by this pondering, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of pondering in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary for the human beings to ponder in order to reach the perfection, in order to perform the self-building. And it cannot be achieved without pondering. Therefore, it is necessary to think, and the ponder in ourselves that when Allah has given me these two arms, why He has given me this? You know, the body that we have, for example, you know, we have a nose which is on my face. I have a mouth from which I eat, I speak. If this mouth was behind my head, was I able to do that? If I never had two hands, would I be eating with the feet? Even if my feet were at the front, the body was the way it is, but the mouth from which I eat, if it was at my back or at my neck, back of neck or back of head, how would I eat? So Allah has created me, He has given me this body, He has given me these two hands, which I can easily pick up things and I can easily break things through this. I can eat, I can chew, I have jaws to eat, and all those things that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These are the first-hand things on which we can ponder and we can reach to the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. An intellectual person, he understands when he ponders in his creation, when he ponders in this universe, that this universe, this system which is all around me, this is for a cause. It is not to just spend time in lust. It is not just for spending my life eating and sleeping. It is not to just spend my life teasing people or just thinking about myself. There is a greater cause behind it. And this greater cause, if we can reach to that with pondering, then we are going towards the self-building and having a good Islamic lifestyle, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar was gripped by fear and chaos after a bomb ripped through a mosque situated close to the police headquarters. The injured were taken to the nearby hospitals by rescue workers. Crowds were seen hurrying to the blast site and hospitals in search of their loved ones.
We were assembled in the mosque for the evening prayers. I was among those who were ready to offer prayers. All of a sudden, a massive explosion occurred and the roof of the mosque collapsed suddenly.
After this attack, the government of Pakistan has vowed to fight back against terrorists until the last drop of their blood.
We will not spare those who want to sabotage the peace of the country. We will chase after them. All political stakeholders should sit together to maintain peace in the country.
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed responsibility for the attack. However, later they distanced themselves from the bombing, saying it was not their policy to target mosques, seminaries, and religious places. Experts say The Pakistani government needs to take up the issue of growing terrorism with neighboring Afghanistan. The Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan militants are said to be hiding in Afghanistan while carrying out attacks inside Pakistan once in a while.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately. The Taliban tried to broker a peace deal with between the government of Pakistan and TTP. Parleys were held, talks were held behind the scene between the security forces of Pakistan and the TTP leadership, but that didn't work.
The country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has appealed to the people for blood donations for the injured in a terrorist attack in Peshawar on Monday.
Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Analysts believe that government has to deal decisively with Taliban militants to maintain peace and economic stability of the country. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation, religion, or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims based on their religious beliefs never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network, and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kyiv and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP-T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP-T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. according to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khaira Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed seven Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khaira Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead nine Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Kandil for Press TV, Occupied Ramallah.
Hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran-burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
Activists informed Press TV how their love for the Quran compelled them to act.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws, as we are living in European continent. The European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim-strong residential areas and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
Geomatics is not a well-known term amongst the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in man's modern life. The second Iran Geo Exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in the field.
Geo means earth, and geomatics is a science and technology that deal with the collection, distribution and analysis of geographic data using aerial and satellite imaging. To put it simply, when you take an online cab, you're using a geomatic technology known as GPS, which is short for Global Positioning System.
Geomatics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in geomatics.
We develop aerial imaging and surveying technologies. We also offer geophysical services. Here in this expo, we're showcasing our imaging and surveying drones, which can draw maps and collect topographical data to facilitate mining operations.
As the organizer of the tech event, the Iranian Defense Ministry says it is planning to encourage more companies to operate in geomatics to turn the strategic field into a viable source of income for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Geomatics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing geomatics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without geomatics, many businesses such as online ride-sharing services would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who was an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available, even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process.
Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the mat, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The Force Commissioner Rowley commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyper is up, London.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubs every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge-based, job-creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. In this episode, and the next two episodes of this series, we will dwell upon the reasons of the leaders' high emphasis on production. Stay tuned, please. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, chooses the theme of every year according to the most important issue of the day. For more than one decade, the leader has put economic names on the Iranian calendar years. This is due to the fact that, for the past decade, the enemies, especially the US, have highly escalated economic war against Iran. Economic sanctions have been imposed on Iran since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. But after the failure of military aggression, the global arrogance and its hangers-on have highly concentrated their attention on economy to affect Iranian nation's livelihood and bring the Islamic system to its knees. This has been seriously put on the agenda of the U.S. regime and its accomplices in Europe and their minions on the region to put Iran's economy in a bottleneck and cause a rift between the people and the ruling system. Ayatollah Khamenei said in 2018 in his speech at the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, peace upon him, that the theme of every year is chosen on two purposes. Firstly, to direct executive policies and practice of government officials. And secondly, to make public opinion heedful. In other words, besides the officials who make decisions, public opinion should also take heed of the theme of the year in its behavioral pattern. The themes that are chosen by the leader for Iranian years are supportive in nature. To make it clear, the leader deeply believes in supporting domestic production as he is fully aware of the internal capacities. This both revives closed industries and strengthens active ones. Moreover, these themes are chosen to counter and thwart foreign pressures, particularly the U.S. sanctions, which have all been imposed illegally to destroy the Iranian nation. Although negotiations have been continued for more than one decade on removal of sanctions, Ayatollah Khamenei has always stressed increase of efforts to thwart sanctions. Years ago, when he raised the resistance economy, the leader emphasized the empowerment of domestic economy to act as a bulwark against economic pressures. In fact, he had accurately predicted the cruel efforts of the enemy to put everything in the list of sanctions. In other words, the U.S. and its comrades in crime would have sanctioned even air and water for the Iranian nation if they had been able. Furthermore, the leader believes that economic interaction with other countries should be based on domestic potentials. He stresses that this interaction would be constructive only when it is done from strong position. In other words, It will be useful when we interact with regional and global customers, mainly as an exporter rather than an importer. As a matter of fact, Ayatollah Khamenei knows the economic challenges facing the government and the people. Dubbing consecutive years with economic themes has aimed at motivating the officials and people to double their efforts and make the best use of the existing capacities to make the best decisions for confronting the cruel enemies. The United States and